The objects of space science can seem especially remote, but their effects can hit quite close to home. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Space science, from astronomy to planetary geology, astronautics to cosmochemistry, is a broad discipline indeed. The diversity and intricate relationships between these research areas is not always appreciated by those not working in the field, and to some, including policymakers, it can seem like an abstract pursuit of distant relevance to life on Earth. One often hears the question, why explore space when we have so many problems to solve right here on Earth? Dr. Duncan Steele is a space scientist with a broad range of experience across many related subfields. He studied the physics of meteors impacting the atmosphere, discovered a dozen asteroids, modeled the behavior of space debris, and published numerous research articles on more topics yet. He holds visiting researcher appointments at several notable research centers, and he's also published several books on scientific topics as they relate to matters of current and future societal concern. Western World's Parshati Patel spoke to Dr. Steele during his recent tenure as a visiting research scholar at Western University about asteroids, meteors, and the relevance of space science to everyday life here on Earth.
All right, welcome to the show, and let me start off by asking you, how did meteor physics occur? Were you very much interested since your childhood, or did you just stumble upon in your undergrad? How did it come up to you to do meteor physics?
I started off studying both physics and astrophysics in London, and later on I went on to start doing a graduate degree in astrophysics, but then diverted a little bit into doing a different master's degree in optics, which of course is all about the design of telescopes and so on and so forth, but also lasers and holography and various other areas of optics, physics. And later after that, I was doing image processing, working on NASA spacecraft, actually at the University of Colorado. And I wanted to go back to a British-style university to do a PhD, but I didn't want to go back to Britain itself. And I just kind of did a bit of searching around, and I found a very interesting research program at the University of Canterbury, which is in New Zealand. There's another university called the University of Kent at Canterbury, which is in England. But this is another University of Canterbury, which is the Canterbury Plains in the South Island of New Zealand. And I ended up going there for 2-3 years to do a PhD on radar studies of meteors, which I found extremely interesting. Very good training in all sorts of different areas of related physics and so on. And I've continued with that and allied research work ever since then.
So I heard you build a radar and you studied orbital characteristics of meteorites. So would you mind to elaborate a bit what your project was actually about? And do you still continue doing that right now?
In New Zealand, I was building a radar. It doesn't look at all like what people think radars look like. They're used to seeing these dishes which are rotating around at airports and so on. In fact, down at lower frequencies or longer wavelengths, which we need to use for radar studies of meteors, they can look more like, if you like, TV antennas, the kind of Yagi antenna you can see on the top of some people's roofs still. Very big antennas, in fact. The antennas I was building for the observatory in New Zealand were 300 meters long, wires stretched between poles up high. And those were used to detect echoes which you would get back from the line of ionization, which is formed when a meteoroid enters the upper atmosphere, and people very often say it burns up. Technically, we say it ablates. It comes in with a lot of energy because it's going at very high speed, and it gives a very short-lived, what we call a meteor train, and it's possible to bounce radio signals off of those. And when the echo comes back with multiple sites, you can determine the speed with which the meteor was going and also its orientation compared to the Earth. From that, you can work your way back to determine what orbit it had around the sun. And then we can use those orbits to search for things like associations with comets. That is, we know that certain meteor showers are associated with different specific comets, like Halley's Comet, for example. And so that whole field is, a study of the small bodies in the solar system. From that, I got interested in bigger objects which might hit the Earth every so often, that is, asteroids and comets. When I'm talking about meteors or meteoroids entering the atmosphere, the typical sizes we detect using these meteor radars is like a millimeter across. And we're not detecting this 1 millimeter size object, we're detecting the ionization it's caused in the atmosphere as it comes zipping in at maybe 30 kilometers per second, extremely high speed. But bigger objects like asteroids and comets we know can and do hit the Earth every so often with catastrophic consequences. It's what we think wiped out the dinosaurs. And so I also got interested in that area, that is, studying asteroids and comets using more familiar types of telescope, that is, optical telescopes.
Yeah, and I guess it's very common right now to study about these objects than it was before, because now we have, you know, risks like Chelyabinsk meteor, which, you know, was highly seen by everyone through, thanks to social media. It was widespread about this meteor. So I guess this area of research kind of picks up now.
Yes, when I started my first search for Earth-approaching asteroids back in 1990, everybody thought I was crazy, suggesting that, indeed things can hit the Earth from time to time and are dangerous to us and we should do something about it. We've often said this is the only form of natural disaster we could actually stop. You can't stop tornadoes, you can't stop hurricanes, you can't stop earthquakes, you can't stop volcanoes, tsunamis and these sorts of things. However, potentially we could stop a big asteroid from hitting the Earth. As I say, the dinosaurs appear to have been wiped out by a massive asteroid or comet hitting the Earth. And some people say a little bit flippantly, well, the dinosaurs went extinct because they didn't have a space program. And that's certainly true. Of course, they didn't also have the brains or the opposable thumbs to do something about it. But we're a bit smarter than them, so there's something we can do. And we do see every so often a reminder of the hazard, which is posed. As you say, the Chelyabinsk event last year, that was only a small asteroid, maybe 15, maybe 20 meters across, something quite small, but it dumped about 500 kilotons of energy into the atmosphere. Huge flash, blinded some people, smashed lots of glass, 1,200 people taken to hospital, thankfully nobody killed. But as I said, it was quite a small object, and we certainly didn't see it beforehand. And such things like this do occur on a timescale of like once every 10 years, once every 20 years, somewhere on the Earth. Most often, obviously, they're going to be over the ocean, but it would be a terrible thing if one were to occur above a densely populated city. So we do need to search for these things. We think even if we couldn't do anything about it, at least we can evacuate the area. Or if maybe it's going to come in across a sensitive area where there are two nations, you know, feuding with each other and potentially at war, obviously something like this could be mistaken to be a nuclear explosive. And therefore, we need to, if you like, educate people worldwide that these things do occur. They are natural events. And also, as I've said, there is something we could do about it if we had a suitable worldwide program.
So as you mentioned, you started looking for these objects. So how do you look for these objects? Because, you know, when you look into the sky, it's dark. These objects, obviously asteroids and comets, would be dark as, you know, if it were further from the sun. So how do you actually look for them?
Spotting asteroids is very difficult because a lot of them are as black as coal. That is, they reflect very little sunlight. In fact, the word asteroid means star-like, literally. It was a term coined by a British astronomer, Sir William Herschel, in 1802. So they look like stars. The difference is that stars move in step across the sky. They appear to move because the Earth is turning, whereas asteroids appear to move relative to the stars. So the way in which we search for them is we need a relatively big telescope, but one in particular with a wide field of view, because we don't know where these things are before we start looking. So we're conducting a surveillance operation of the sky, covering a wide area. You can take one image of an area and then move on to others and then come back to the original spot, the original place you looked at maybe an hour later, take another frame, another image, and then if you blink the two against each other, the stars will appear to stand still, but the asteroid, if there is one there, will appear to move. It's moved from one position to another. It may be a tiny amount, only a few pixels it's moved on a CCD image, but nevertheless, we can write software to find these things, pick out the objects which are moving, and then we can use other telescopes to track them and determine their orbits around the sun. having determined their orbits around the sun, we also have the mathematical ability to see where that asteroid will be into the future. In fact, when we've got a well-determined orbit, we can predict where it will be for about the next 100 years. And obviously what we do is, if you like, we see where it's going to be and see whether it's going to coincide with the Earth, because if it is, we've got big problems. An example of this is that in just a few months' time, a comet which was discovered, in fact, last year, very early in January of 2013, we know in October this year, 2014, it will make a very close flyby of Mars, actually closer than any comet has ever been observed to miss the Earth. This one's going to come very close to Mars. That may show us something about, you know, what can happen to a terrestrial-type planet like the Earth when a comet flies extremely close by. Now, that involves an awful lot of very complicated mathematics, obviously, making that prediction, and very diligent astronomical measurements and so on. But it is something we are scientifically and technologically capable of, whereas when I started my first asteroid search program back in 1990, the first such program in the Southern Hemisphere, because I was working in Australia at that time, it's something we couldn't have done, actually predicting orbits into the future. It's only with more powerful computers and development of the mathematical techniques that we've now become able to do that. So that's a useful thing, I think, to be able to do.
Yeah, I guess saving Earth from such huge asteroids and I would say comets would be probably one of the main areas where governments will be investing money trying to find ways to stop these.
Yeah, I mean, when we try and justify the government's funding astronomical research, there's a number of different reasons you could give. I mean, one is that people say, oh, well, it's a cultural pursuit. Well, the answer the government can give to that is, well, okay, we'll fund it the same way as we fund opera, you know, which is without much money. No, the real arguments are, you know, it's good for education. Astronomy is just mathematics and physics in disguise. Astronomy and planetary science. Planetary science includes geology and so on. So by people studying these subjects, we can get people coming through who've got good educations, who can go into industry, exploration, minerals processing, and all these sorts of things. However, the real fundamental argument in favour of research in something which appears to be somewhat abstract, like astronomy, is that occasionally it turns up something which is useful. And obviously, knowing that potentially the Earth could be hit by a big asteroid with terrible consequences for our civilizations, that's useful. There are other areas of astronomy which are also useful. It used to be that astronomy was our way of timekeeping. Well, since quartz clocks were developed back almost 100 years ago, there have been more accurate ways of doing timekeeping. So now timekeeping is the domain of the physics laboratory with very sophisticated atomic clocks, no longer the domain of astronomy. However, astronomy does, as I say, turn up useful things from time to time. Another area I've worked on, in fact, is the astronomical causes, potentially, of climate change. Something people haven't looked at, I think, in enough detail so far, but it does turn out that the Earth's orbit, as it changes, an abstract piece of astronomical knowledge, does actually lead to changes in the arrival of solar radiation at different places at different times over the year. And I find that, in fact, this is a pretty good little piece of evidence which indicates that at least some component of the currently observed climate change and the so-called global warming actually has a natural cause. That, I think, is an important thing to realise. And again, it comes from, you know, an abstract science. Studying the Earth's orbit, you think, what's the point in that? Well, it's useful to know where we are as we go around the sun, but it has important consequences for us in everyday life.
And I guess that would also have consequences if we are calculating orbits for the asteroids and comets coming close to us, right?
Yeah, we need to know where the Earth is if we're going to predict an impact. Mm-hmm. There are lots of other reasons for being, you know, wanting to know things about orbits. I mean, the whole of our, you know, human civilization nowadays depends upon space science, which is an outgrowth from basic astronomy. Right now, while we're speaking, the World Cup is on in Brazil. We're watching it live. You know, the signals are being beamed around the world by satellites, Fox. And when you get the fantastic weather forecast, because weather forecasts now are really accurate. You know, people complain, but actually we can usually tell pretty accurately what the weather is going to be several days ahead of time. So you can plan, are you going to go camping this weekend? No, the weather forecasts say it's going to rain, and usually they're pretty accurate. Well, those come, that comes from meteorological satellites, which are in orbit, looking down, telling us things about the way in which the weather is going to change. Equally well, we do things like geological remote sensing to see where new mineral ores are, which we might go and exploit. We can do that from orbit. It's cheaper, and it's, if you like, friendlier than having geologists marching around the country with rock hammers. They can only cover so much ground, but from orbit you can cover a big area. Equally well, a lot of the broad acre farming which is done, the agriculture nowadays, depends upon satellite imagery being regularly obtained from orbit. Farmers can tell if their crop of corn or wheat is not progressing like it should do. Maybe there's a blight, maybe there's some pest, and it tells them, hey, go out and spray that 1,000 hectares with some sort of bug spray or whatever else it may be, or a particular fertilizer which is needed. Because, of course, they can't sample the whole of that 1,000 yeah. hectares. From orbit, we can. It's actually quite easy. It's quite straightforward. And although it sounds like science fiction, a lot of this is very commonplace, straightforward stuff. And yet, you know, when we started space exploration back a little bit more than 50 years ago, everybody thought, this is, you know, this is terrible. What a waste of money. Well, the whole of our civilizations now really depend on space research and space science. That's the way it is. Life just wouldn't be the same if it weren't for satellites in orbit. And so that money spent all the way back then was well invested, I think.
Yeah, and I guess you talked about the climate change, the effect of astronomical parameters on climate change. And if you look right now, it's more the climate physics people looking at what's going on with the climate change. And basically, most of it is due to humans, you know, putting up CO2 and other emission gases in the atmosphere, which obviously lead to this warming. And you talked a bit about how the astronomical parameters are affecting. Would you mind to elaborate a little bit on it?
Well, up until now, as far as I can see, the climate scientists have neglected an important effect. That is, they usually assume that the Earth's orbit changes very, very slowly. It turns out that's not true. For example, the date of perihelion, that is the date when the Earth is closest to the sun, actually moves by about one day every 58 years. So that's like a bit less than a human lifetime nowadays. And one day is a significant amount, and it makes quite a difference. Again, few people are aware of the fact that between perihelion, that is our closest approach to the sun, and aphelion, which is our furthest point away from the sun, the intrinsic flux of sunlight hitting the Earth at our distance away from the sun, which, as I said, is varying, actually changes by almost 7%. And that's a significant amount. So clearly, as perihelion and aphelion move, because the Earth's orbit is gradually swiveling around, that will have a climatic effect. It is changing the lengths of the seasons and also the characteristics, because the intensity of the sunlight is naturally changing. So that's one aspect. That's a natural aspect. If I move on to the so-called greenhouse gases, like increasing carbon dioxide, water vapor, methane, and so on, which have certainly carbon dioxide has increased since the Industrial Revolution, 1750 to 1800. We've seen that go up, and we've seen the temperature go up, and there appears to be a link. But if you're going to understand how that happens, again, it comes back to actually astronomy. It has to do with the opacity or the absorption by the atmosphere of different wavelengths. We know that if we're going to do infrared astronomy, then we either need to put the telescope up on a satellite, or we need to go to a very, very dry place on the Earth's surface, because you need to get to high altitude and above the moisture at low altitude in order to be able to access the infrared parts of the spectrum. So, for example, astronomers like to put observatories now in places like the Andes in Chile and so on, at high altitude, where they're above a lot of the water vapor, or in Hawaii, very high up, 14,000 feet up a volcano, because there they're above most of the water vapor, and then they can observe from the ground on top of this mountain, not only across the optical region, that is where our eyes can see, but also into the infrared. And that's because water vapor, in particular, absorbs a lot of the infrared. And it is indeed that absorption which is, we believe, causing this man-made greenhouse effect. So it's our studies of what wavelengths of radiation can actually make it through the atmosphere, which is informing our knowledge of the way in which increasing carbon dioxide can actually make the temperature go up. Equally well, our basic model of greenhouse effect in some ways stems from Carl Sagan's PhD thesis. Back in 1960, he graduated from the University of Chicago, and in his thesis, he investigated why the planet Venus has such a high temperature. Temperature on Venus at the surface is about 500 degrees Celsius. The reason why is it has a very dense carbon dioxide atmosphere, and it's applying the same knowledge of physics and so on to the Earth as Sagan applied to Venus, which gives us this idea of the greenhouse effect on the Earth, potentially pushing up the temperature by a little bit. Not as hot as it is on Venus. There are reasons for that. That is, Venus doesn't have water. That's why it has lots of carbon dioxide. On the Earth, we have lots of water. The water absorbs carbon dioxide, lays it down as carbonate rocks, limestone, and so on. And because of that, we have relatively small amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But the basic physics underlying that idea is exactly the same as Sagan set out in his PhD thesis. Again, another good reason why doing astronomy and planetary science research is good, because it does turn up every so often, you very, very useful, very, very important things.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back a bit about asteroids. So I read that you actually discovered one of the asteroids which is spinning so fast it cannot be a rebel pile, which is what a normal asteroids are thought to be, right?
Yeah, this was a bit of a peculiarity, finding this relatively fast spinning asteroid. We were tracking asteroids in order to determine their positions and so that their orbits would be able to be determined. And this was a particular asteroid called 1995 HM, which had been discovered just a few weeks before by the Space Watch team at the University of Arizona. And they realized it was moving south. My team in Australia said, okay, we can take over the tracking when you can no longer see it from Arizona. Now, the way which we would normally do that is take two frames spaced by 5 or 10 minutes, maybe an hour, and then blink them against each other to find the moving object. And when we did this for this asteroid, we saw that it almost disappeared between the two. And yet the stars appeared the same brightness, but we had a bright spot for the asteroid. 5 minutes later, it had almost disappeared. We said, well, what's going on? And I said, well, maybe it's shaped like a banana. That is, at one time, we're looking sideways at the banana, and then 5 minutes later, you're looking at it end on, and so it's not very bright at all. And we thought, well, that's interesting. We better keep tracking this. So we kept tracking it, although we'd never done anything like this before, just to see how does its brightness vary. And we found its brightness varied with a cycle time of about 97 minutes, it turns out. Well, we knew that, in fact, when you do, again, the standard physics, any object which is spinning faster than about once every 2.5 hours, 150 minutes, must be held together by its own tensional strength, its physical strength. All asteroids which had been observed previously to determine their spin rates had had spin periods of more than 150 minutes, and so the basic idea was it appears that all asteroids are rubble piles, that is, they're lumps of separate rock, they're held together by their own self-gravity. Kind of like I say, it's like a rubble pile orbiting through space. Their self-gravity holds them together, but they don't have any intrinsic strength sticking those rocks together. Now, well, this one, because it was spinning that fast, we knew had to be a monolith, that is, a single rock, because it needed to be something which was held together by its own tensional strength. And it was indeed the first asteroid to be spinning that fast and therefore demonstrated to be a monolith. It's kind of a paradox that there's, you know, probably 50 astronomers around the world who'd studied spinning asteroids and measured the spin rates of maybe 1,000 of them, never found one spinning at faster than once every 150 minutes. We weren't even looking for one doing that, but by chance, we did realize that this was spinning that fast. Since then, another handful of asteroids have been realized to be spinning faster than that canonical limit of about once every 2.5 hours, and so they're also thought to be monoliths. You could say, again, you know, what's the use of this? Well, if one of these was found to be on a path which is going to get it to hit the Earth, we might like to be able to deflect it. Mm-hmm. But clearly, dealing with a single lump of rock is different to dealing with a rubble pile. It's actually quite difficult to push a rubble pile and keep it intact, whereas a single rock is, you know, more straightforward, maybe. So again, we need to know about the physical and chemical and strength properties and so on of asteroids and indeed comets if we are ever going to need to deal with one, just in case. You really want to know what sort of techniques you might be able to use to divert one of these objects, and it's a matter of, it's best to know your enemy, to know how your enemy will behave if you give him or her a good shove. which is what we would need to do in the case of an asteroid determined to be on a collision course with the Earth.
And I guess its origins would matter and would be helpful as well, because, you know, again, ties back to understanding the formation of solar system in terms of such monolithic rocks floating around our solar system.
I certainly believe that in science it's important to develop an understanding of the whole thing, as it were. That is, you can't just collect facts. You know, collect facts is stamp collecting. It's very nice, but, you know, the essence of science is developing an understanding. And in the military especially, they quite often call something which is called the DICU hierarchy. DICU is D-I-K-U-W, okay? Data is data. The D is data. It's what you collect at a telescope or in some other experiment. It's actually numbers. Now, when you put the numbers together, you can develop information. So you get it into your Excel spreadsheet on your computer, you're getting an aggregation of data which gives you information. And then when you analyze that information, you can get knowledge, you can get a better idea. It can tell us things about, oh, well, yes, you know, a certain fraction of asteroids are this composition, a certain fraction are that, and so on. That's knowledge. Then eventually you like to take all of the information and the knowledge you've got together and get you, that is, the understanding. The understanding of how the whole thing works, how it all is put together. So understanding, you know, the theory of evolution, it's an important push forward for science and so on, and we're still developing understandings. In this case, understanding all the small bodies in the solar system and how they relate to the planets and how they've caused mass extinction events on the Earth and so on, that's all useful information, knowledge, understanding. But the final part of the DICU hierarchy is W for wisdom. That is, you get the wisdom to behave accordingly or react accordingly. And it may be that the reaction is, oh, well, we think that the risk is pretty low of a big asteroid hitting the Earth, therefore we really don't need to worry about it. Or maybe it's the other way around and you actually say, hey, you know, in fact, it's kind of uncomfortable how often these big things hit the Earth. So maybe our wisdom says it will be a good thing to invest a certain amount of money in searching for these things and so on. I've got to say that I don't think that should be a civilian science push, as it were, searching for all these objects, because it's quite routine. It comes back to stamp collecting again. It's a defence-type project, and the defence forces around the world are pretty good at doing routine things again and again and again. And scientists like me, meanwhile, we've walked off somewhere else, we found something else interesting to study. But that's the essence, again, of doing science. We're not trying to produce directly a new technological output, a new gadget which could be sold. We're not trying to produce, certainly not trying to get ourselves employed to spend thousands of hours on telescopes. I've done enough of that, thanks very much. It's more, you know, here's an outcome from our research, and we think that you, the people of Canada, you, the government of Canada, the governments of the world, the United Nations, should know about this and act accordingly. We've tried to develop this understanding, and we hope that we can help you with a little bit of wisdom here.
Okay, so we are running out of time, but it was great talking to you, trying to understand how important these near-Earth asteroids and asteroids and comets are. And hopefully we get to talk to you again soon.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Duncan Steele, and he works in a variety of areas.
Yes.
So. Yes.
His study of asteroids, of course, is incredibly interesting, and I think very prescient. The way he talks about it is also the way I think about it. It is really, really important. We should be devoting resources towards the discovery and study of these bodies, because there are far more of them, far closer to Earth than anybody really has any. It's more than is comfortable.
Yes.
I think that what he says is totally true. I think this is something we can do something about, as opposed to, say, an earthquake or a tornado. We can do something about this, and we should be at least developing some kind of plan, some kind of idea of how we deal with such a situation.
His arguments were really coherent. He expresses them very clearly. I don't think I'd ever thought that of all the natural disasters, this is one that we could prepare for.
Yeah.
And do something about.
Yeah.
And his arguments in favor of the justification of his area of study really applied to all of astronomy, and I thought he was very good explaining how astronomy and space science has helped society and will continue to do so. It was one of the best formed arguments I've heard for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people to understand that, you know, the money that you give to science, and especially space sciences, doesn't go to waste, as everyone keeps talking about. Because, hey, your GPS wouldn't be working properly if you would not have a satellite up there that keeps, you know, sending you signals back. Or, you know, you could have a lot of, you know, there are a lot of different things that you should thank space sciences for.
I think that people do have this idea about the space sciences in particular, about science kind of in general, that it's almost disposable, you know, that it's a nice to have. And they have this idea while they're driving around in their car, talking to people on their mobile phone, using their phone to figure out how to get to this office they had to go and work out through their GPS, all the while when they get indoors, they're watching TV, they're on their computer, they're using the internet, and then turning around and they're saying that they should stop spending money on space science. I think that it's... His argument was, I think, totally valid, and something that perhaps people have shied away from, but this idea that you should allow the kind of research into it because you might find something that's useful. A lot of the time, some of the most useful things come from areas that nobody would have thought when they started on that. That's not to be underestimated, the importance of that.
In the end, we're interested, I think we all care for the well-being of society and humanity. And there are clearly a lot of problems around the world. There are a lot of needs that are not being met because they're underfunded. But I don't think science research is where we should look to make up that shortfall. I mean, we have other issues, and probably in terms of defense and security and things that probably could be discussed. But the benefits of scientific research and applications have contributed many, many things to social well-being.
Yeah, I mean, when we go to classrooms and talk about what we call spin-off technologies, it's very interesting that people don't know that there are a lot of things that they use in everyday life. Like, I'm not talking about, you know, maybe once a month you use something. Things like camera on your cell phone, ingestible toothpaste, or cordless drills, things like that, that, you know, you don't think about it while you're using it, but that actually is a result of, you know, people working actually towards making space science better, but then give out things that actually end up you using it in everyday life. So when we look for funding for sciences, we have to justify our, you know, endeavor, whatever we are doing, doesn't matter if it's planetary science or astronomy or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, what we get out of it, might change the world. You never know.
That's totally true. And in the case of Duncan Steele, the study of asteroids is something that could actually help the world in a very, very direct way. It's not something that's guaranteed to happen in the kind of timescales that most people are worried about, but it could happen.
Well, I mean, we have talked about these before in our roundtables when, you know, these asteroids up here that he's looking for, which could be very close by to us. Like, you know, people have thought about mining it. There are actually companies who actually has funding to do research on things like mining asteroids. So looking asteroids that might hit us someday might actually be a reason that people would, A, do research on how to divert it now that it's coming to Earth, But then there are also people who would be like, okay, now that it's going to be diverted but close to Earth, how can we mine it? So there's not just one thing that's going to come out of trying to find asteroids that are going to kill us. If you are going to find some that are close to Earth, we might actually be able to use them for a lot more reasons than just killing humans on Earth.
Yes, exactly right.
I was interested in his discovery of this banana-shaped asteroid that was spinning very fast and proved that it wasn't conglomerate, that it was actually solid.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a novel idea and an important one. If we are facing some possible scenario where we have one of these hurling towards us, hurtling.
Yeah. I mean, there is a difference between one big monolithic rock coming towards us and one rubble pile coming towards us.
Yeah.
That would change the way we would tackle it, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't want to shoot out the rubble pile. You're just going to spread things around.
Right.
You might want to just give it a tap and let it do its work.
There was another thing that he brought up more than once in his defense of astronomy, which was the significance of astronomical observations and calculations, the effect it has on our climate. And I found that really interesting. He referred to changes in the Earth's orbit, and it was Milankovitch. The Milankovitch cycles describe these various changes in the Earth's orbit, how it has an effect on climate. But we have other effects, other magnetic effects and modulation of cosmic rays, which may affect cloud cover. And even though those aren't things that we can change, and we do have to focus on the man-made effects, I think we are treading a dangerous path if we ignore these effects.
Yeah.
Whether one is more important than the other, it's a bit like the nature-nurture debate with children.
Yeah.
It's education and it's genetics, both.
Yeah.
Let's focus on education.
Yeah.
We can't do anything about genetics, but we still need to understand the whole picture so that we know what's happening.
And I think the listeners could actually go to his website. He actually blogs very frequently, and he talks about all different kinds of things that he's involved in, including this idea of, you know, how external factors could make the change that we are seeing in the climate. But he's also one of the investigators of this Malaysian plane that actually vanished over Malaysia. And so he has been working on helping the team, trying to understand the data that was relayed to the satellite. And he actually blogs frequently about this, so you guys could just go onto his blog and read all about it.
That's very interesting. I mean, like we said at the beginning, he's not really in one spot. He's in many spots, and it's always an interesting situation to find yourself in, to be able to turn your skills to many different areas.
Two little things that I don't know if I'm reading too much into what he said, but he said the so-called global warming or so-called greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
Am I reading too much? Is there an effect? How important it is still to be determined. Is this telling us a little bit more about what his position is than he wants to say?
I think he's talking about his position because he really wants people to use all the available possible scenarios. So it's not probably just the greenhouse gases. There might be external, you know, astronomical phenomena that they have not taken into consideration, which would explain the rise in the temperatures.
Yes.
So he really wants people who study this to take into account everything they see, because the panel that has been working, IPCC, the panel that has been working has not taken those things into account, according to him. And he would want to see more of inclusion of everything to understand what is responsible for.
I mean, my personal viewpoint on this is that I personally feel that these things that our civilization does should change, but I feel, I mean, obviously the climate issue is very important, pressing, but I also just kind of think, you know, we've been doing some things for a long time. I'm pretty sure we're smarter than this. There's better ways of doing these things. There's more efficient ways of getting these outputs in our society. We should really change them anyway. Having said that, I'm also a stickler for having accurate and preferably large volumes of data. And I also really appreciate his viewpoint that he puts across, that there's still more information that needs to be included in these models. We should include as much information as possible in these models. I think that there is a climate issue. I think that the produce of our society is the primary driver. But I also think that his point is very valid. The Earth's position in the galaxy and the universe, look at the amount of energy coming out of various objects in the galaxy. It has to have an effect. You know, the Earth is not in a glass bowl. It's open to the outside. So having models that take into account things like high energy rays from the sun, from extra solar activity, that has to go into those models as well, so that we can have an even more accurate idea of what is going on.
I agree. We need to take in all these different factors, but the important point is that we are responsible for surviving and maintaining a sustainable society. So hopefully all this information will help us achieve that.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts John Kissy, Parshati Patel, and Tony Martinez. Our editors were John Kissy, Tony Martinez, and Parshati Patel. And I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. And on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again next week, right here on Western Worlds. Thank you.